Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Yes, we are burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your weekly fix of anything and everything related to design, through creative arts, and architecture. This week, I want to talk about a different approach to the production of housing. I have with us an architect and a house maestro, Greg La Vardera. Greg, are you there?
I'm here.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, very phonetically, La Vardera.
La Vardera, thank you. In no particular order, let's just run through some of the topics I'd like to talk to or with you about today, and then we'll take a little bit of a break to set up an appropriate acoustical theme and then let her rip. These are things I'd like to talk about. As I understand it, you're very interested in energy conservation, the approaches that have been taken in Scandinavia, understandably, where they have severe weather, especially prefabricated or industrialized housing production in Sweden. I'd like to know how it is that you became interested in that, what you took away, how you've adapted that for the United States market. What do you think about the Danish energy code, if we have time to get into that? And you can flog yourself a little bit, talk about your own background and the kinds of projects that you're working on. So I know that's a lot to think about. Let's set the stage for talking about Swedish things with a very brief Swedish song.
Helangor, sjung hoppa la 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 la. Helangor, sjung hoppa la la la. Åren som inte helan tar han eller inte halvan får. Helangor, sjung hoppa la la la.
Hey! If you're Swedish, or if you know Swedes, or if you've been to Sweden, where three or more Swedes are gathered, there will be drinking. And if there is drinking, there will be singing. And if there is singing, the Swedes will be singing Helangor. Greg, have you been to Sweden?
Yes, many years ago, though.
Okay, well, I think they were singing it then. Tala du svensk.
Are you just hitting me with some Swedish greeting? Because it sailed over my
head. Oh, that's okay. I was just asking if you spoke Swedish.
I don't.
Okay. No problem. The Swedes all speak English. So,
that's true.
You work on a lot of housing.
I am. I do. It's a big part of my local practice, and also a big part of my sort of experimental practice, where I market house plans in the American tradition.
You mean like they have yards instead of they're just all attached and linear?
No, it's an unusual situation in the United States that you can buy, you know, house plans through catalogs so readily. Most other countries don't have that industry. For Sweden, for example, buying houses from catalogs is very common. Buying house plans, very unusual.
Catalogs of an actual, like leafing through an IKEA catalog and buying a kitchen.
Yes, and it's all marketed with great sophistication. From housing manufacturers, you will receive fancy, glossy brochures, much like you would expect to have handed to you if you went to a car dealership here. You page through pictures of options and pictures of happy families living in the house models that they sell. They'll sit you down at a desk and you'll sign papers, and within a few months that house will appear on your property.
And that means, you say appear, you mean it comes on a truck?
More or less, yeah. The foundation has to be built on site.
Of course.
But the bulk of the house is built in a factory. They do have some manufacturers in Sweden that build using a modular system, which is more common here in the United States. But the vast majority of them build flat panels that come out on the back of a truck and are quickly craned into place. For instance, the house would typically be delivered and set up and under roof, if not under shingle, but under roof on the same day.
Wow.
They assemble them very rapidly.
Right. For those of you who are listening who are civilians, that is to say neither architects nor builders, by what Greg means modular in the United States, it means something like a mobile house or a trailer or a trailer-sized prefabricated, but with three or four sides of that component of a stackable structure. By modular, you're talking about a wall panel or a floor panel of a certain thickness by a length that will fit on a truck that could go on the roads.
Correct. The modular system divides the house into sections that are roadable. I mean, typically in the United States, that may mean anywhere from 8 feet wide to 12 feet wide, depending on the regulations in individual states. And again, heights are limited. It depends on the path that they have to take to the site. So those large sections of houses are built up in the factory, loaded on trucks. If they're wide, sometimes they need special following cars with flashing lights. They're trucked to the site, very large-scale crane, lifts them into place. And then typically the outside of the house has no siding on it, has to be sided. Various joints on the inside of the house have to be healed. Now, they do that in Sweden as well. It's not as popular, but even when they do modular housing in Sweden, the wall panels are built first and assembled in the factory in the same way that they assemble panelized houses in the field. So they're still building those modular houses in a very different way than we do.
Right. Most of the construction still in the United States. I don't really know that much about Canada, although I do know that building practices tend to be fairly consistent across English-speaking North America.
Yeah. I forget the precise
stick
percentage,
built.
But yeah. We, somewhere under 10% of houses perhaps are built in factories in the United States.
Right.
Vast majority of those being modular. Now, contrast that to Sweden, where, say, 95% of houses are built in the factory, and, you know, maybe 5% are built in on-site.
Greg, you're kind of, in terms of audio stream, you're kind of going in and out. I don't know if you have background noise that's coming in waves that's causing your phone to do some audio discrimination.
We'll see how it does now.
All right, good. How did you become interested in this alternative means of producing houses?
Well, my Much now better. Friend, Scott Hedges, is an American that was living in Sweden. He had been a Finnish carpenter here in the United States. And
is that Finnish as in from Finland or Finnish as in...
Finnish as in cabinetry.
Uh-huh.
And bookcases and other kinds of interior woodwork. And he had relocated with his family to Sweden. And during his time there, he took a job as a Finnish carpenter for a contractor that did the fieldwork side of house building in Sweden. Now, so he contacted me, and he had been a reader of my blog and following my houseplant business. And one of the things that I had written about in the past and was sort of an ongoing development here in the United States was this renewed interest in prefabrication. And while there's been a tremendous interest in prefabrication that sort of bloomed in the past 10 years here, it never sort of took hold or made a large impact on the industry. So basically, he contacted me to say, look, this is how they do things here, and it's pervasive. Things in Sweden are very similar to the United States in some ways. And he just wanted to know if I was curious about it. And that just developed into a long dialogue, which we then started documenting through a series of blog posts that we co-wrote together and I published onto my blog.
Well, what were those?
Well, we started by sort of systematically looking at how they were building houses in Sweden and examining how it differed from the United States in a regulatory way as well as in a detail way. The United States, we have certain laws and jurisdictions that sort of get in the way of prefabrication being straightforward and easy.
We also have labor union pushback.
Well, that's an issue too. Although large house manufacturers in the United States may use labor that is unionized, and they build a large number of the houses in the United States. But many more of the houses are built by small builders who are not union. If anything, a move to push more American housing into factories would probably put more of that work into union hands than has been in the past.
Yes, and for those of you who are listening from Europe or Scandinavia, what you have to understand about the United States is that outside of the major metropolitan areas, although New York, L.A., Chicago, Boston account for a really high portion of our population, the rest of the country is still in a previous period of American sentiment. You might call it cowboy culture, but they in places in parts of the Deep South and in the Southwest and in the certain parts of the Pacific Northwest, and certainly in the middle and in the Midwestern states, don't like the idea of being compelled to have to join a club in order to have to work. It's a very big continental country we have here. So support for union for trade unions, labor unions in the United States really depends on where you are in the country and what the economic conditions are.
So also in that same vein, we have many states, many jurisdictional boundaries, and when a house crosses those boundaries, now it's being built under possibly a different building code.
That's true.
And building inspections and permitting and examinations, all that is handled on a local basis here. So to build a house in another state and then bring it in, which means that the building inspector is not going to be able to visit that house during construction, which the industry in the United States deals with that using what they call third-party certifications. A consultant is hired by the factory to observe and evaluate their work and then certify that it's according to code. But that has to be something that's accepted in the community where the house ultimately will be delivered. So that becomes another barrier to easily bringing a house somewhere else after you've built it.
Right. They're really, in our lifetimes, it's not feasible that there would ever be a national code. Although a lot of jurisdictions are adopting some tincture or flavor of the International Building Code.
Yes, absolutely. But there's still a lot of variation.
Absolutely. I mean, up until a few years ago, if you were building something according to BOCA, the Building Owners Construction, I don't know. What did BOCA stand for? I don't know. Anyway, there was a BOCA code. It was very popular in the Northeast. Massachusetts adopted that. Connecticut had a flavor of that. Totally different from the Southern Building Code, which addressed a lot of the climatic problems of hurricanes, for example, which is totally different from the Uniform Building Code, which was very prevalent in the western United States, which has or had a lot of emphasis on seismic restraint, which is similar but different from wind restraint. But we don't need to get into that because this is intended to be something accessible to people of all different stripes. What have you learned from the Swedes?
Well, they don't have that issue. I mean, they're one country, one building code. I mean, that's not something that we can reconcile here easily. But that's one of the reasons why prefabrication isn't more widespread here than it is. There's just a series of obstacles that are inherent in our market that would need to be overcome. Now, they can be overcome, and there are. There are prefabricated builders here in the United States that will go to any state. There are many modular factories that cross many state lines and navigate the various road permits they need to cross each state. So those things can be overcome, but it's one of the reasons why it's more difficult. Looking at it on the Swedish side, we see that the physical components of building have all been adapted and slightly tweaked to make building in the factory easier and assembling in the field easier. One of the things that's really easy to see this in is electrical components. In the United States, anybody that's worked on wiring in their home or delved into it a little bit knows that anytime you cut a wire and you're going to have an electrical connection in the United States, you have to have a junction box.
Yep.
So, and that needs a cover. It needs to be accessible. Can't have a wire connection that's buried in the wall to never be seen again. So what that means is if you're going to build a house made out of panels, and those panels are going to be finished on the interior and the exterior the way they are in Sweden, it means your wiring is going to be in place. And when your wall goes to be assembled in the field, you will have to make those wire connections where those walls come together. And it means you're going to have an electrical box or something where those two ends come together, which isn't practical. And number two, you'll have to have an electrician there when the panel is hanging from a crane to make those connections so that they can set the wall. That's just not a sequence of events that is realistic for anybody.
Well, I wish to beg to differ somewhat. I could foresee a 40-foot length of panelized house wall with all the outlets wired, with at either end an outlet box, which is a junction box, with conduit that mates up with the next panel, either around the corner or, if it's a very long house, the next linear extension, and that in the field, an electrician is only running cable between those last 12 feet, two boxes, 12 feet apart, according to current practice. But everything else was all wired up.
Well, the Swedes have a residential conduit system, which is more similar to our commercial wiring, where we have either flexible metal shielded cable or hard bent pipe conduit. In residential construction, we use a plastic shielded cable,
right?
Which is why those connections have to be made in the junction box,
otherwise known as Romex.
Correct.
Right.
So they have a flexible, like accordion plastic conduit that their conductors are run through. And those pieces literally snap together. So they install the boxes and the conduit with pull cords. And when that panel is being lowered in the field, all the carpenter has to do is snap together the two adjacent conduit pieces, and the electrician later will fish or pull his wire easily through them.
So they're pulling all the cable in the field.
Right. Well, they don't have to pull all of them. They can pre-wire as much of it as they wish.
Within a panel.
Right. Just as you described, and then they can leave the wires that need to cross panel lines, they can complete in the field easily. So that's like, you know, not something that's terribly different from our electrical products, but makes the assembly process in the field so much easier and needing so much less coordination.
Now this this paradise of simplicity that you're describing, is it? Does it result in exceedingly lower cost per square meter as opposed to the American system?
Well, it's hard to make direct comparisons. Because number one, they're building much better quality houses than we are. They're building. They're building much more energy efficient houses than we are. So there's not a direct comparison, but. I will say that because they are building highly energy-efficient walls, there's a lot more material in their walls, a lot more insulation. Part of the reason that they can affordably do that in the factory is because there is so much more value in the construction of their walls than ours.
Uh-huh.
When we build walls that are thin and inexpensive the way that we do, you can only save so much from building it in the factory because there's just not that many operations that go on. So, you know, it's like trying to squeeze efficiency out of a rock. If you have a fairly complex wall system that's thicker, has more insulation, has more layers, then suddenly being able to have all those operations go on under roof, not having to have subcontractors return and make multiple trips because it's all laid out on a table, suddenly you're making great efficiency.
Well, now, I know I really have to interrupt you because you're getting way out there on the paradise of Sweden being, you know, this socialist democracy paradigm of everything great and beautiful and wonderful and how groovy things are. Now, let's just remind ourselves that one thing that, Jack, a break is coming up, that Sweden and America happen to share. I don't know who invented it first, but let's hear a little death metal and take a break.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was Death Breath, a Swedish death metal band, and you know, that would be the reaction here in the United States to the insinuation that we should pay more in first cost. My God, we're already paying up to 500, 600 bucks a square foot for some kinds of construction. How dare you, Mr. Architect, suggest that we spend even more?
$500, $600. Well, not for the average house. That
no. Well, I've seen houses that cost almost that much. The
sure.
McMansions of the previous era of excess. Mm-hmm. But that included all kinds of gold-plated Trump-type, you know, fittings and things like that.
Yeah, very often. I mean, those houses would have, you know, perhaps a lot invested in, you know, fancy kitchens or elaborate bathrooms. They may, you know, have splurged for a stone facade on the front. Any number of things that could drive the cost up. But even those extremely fancy houses, at best, would have a 2x6 wall with R19 insulation.
Right. Where's, but I'm playing devil's advocate here. Where's the resale value in a low or nearly net zero house, Mr. Architect? I mean, who can see that? People can see the quality in a stone facade. People can see the quality in having a double height space great hall.
Right. Now you're getting into
the realities of the real estate business. Yes.
Our appraisal system, where there is no evaluation and value placed on the energy efficiency of a house. And,
right.
I don't have a good answer for that. I've done my own share of rants about that. I've had clients that, you know, have had to struggle to get an appraisal that showed the proper value of their house because it's being, you know, compared to other houses locally that don't have the same level of quality of design or materials. And current appraisals, our appraisal industry really is not geared up to handle that. So we have a whole housing industry that now is sort of,
obsolete.
Well, and it's woken to the idea that, well, we have to build more energy efficient houses. In fact, the public is starting to request it, and they find themselves in this position where lenders won't fund that extra investment in, say, insulation or tighter construction. Because it doesn't show up on the appraisal sheet. And so that leaves the consumer to either to fund that themselves with a larger down payment or to not do it at all. So that's a big stumbling block in the way of us stepping up our game in housing in the States.
Well, that's one of the rants of Duo Dickinson, who was our guest 2 weeks ago, who spoke about the difference between flipping and trading up and the with staying put.
Sure. Well, it would be nice if we had a situation where even somebody that wanted to flip an energy efficient house could have that energy efficiency reflected in the value of the house.
Yeah, but if you had a really energy efficient house and you wanted something larger or smaller that was equally energy efficient, you'd be hard-pressed to find something like that without, lowballing a bid on something smaller that was an energy hog and spending a lot of money in aggravation. Fixing it, right.
Yeah, well, you're right, absolutely right.
Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I see in the designs that you have on your company website, which is lamidesign.com?
Lamidesign.com.
Right.
You're speaking of the house plan catalog. It's,
well, you talk about the Swedish wall and the USA wall.
Okay.
And both of them exhibit aspects of the passive house approach from Darmstadt, Germany. And we've had several episodes which you loyal listeners will have heard all about Dr. Feist and Passive House. But I understand that Passive House, you know all about Passive House, I'm sure. You're probably certified as a Passive House.
No, I'm not, actually. And I know a lot about it, but I'm not certified. And in many ways, I'm trying to sort of keep an arm's distance between these proposals, this USA New Wall and the Swedish platform framing that you mentioned. I think clearly they could be used in a house that was going for that certification, but...
Well, you know, a certification is all well and good, but to me as an architect, the real proof is, you know, the comfort for the people living in the house and the cost of living. But now I've been told by Michael McDonough, an architect in New York, mm-hmm. who's a big proponent of
sustainability
and also of aerated autoclaved concrete,
mm-hmm.
Which is high-tech kind of concrete block that exhibits some interesting like phase change materials. I'm talking to the architects right now. It's got some interesting thermodynamic properties. Anyway, he says, and I met him just a couple of weeks ago, he's telling me that the Danish energy codes are becoming the model for Europe, for the European Union. Do you know anything about the Danish? I don't know anything about the Danish energy codes.
I've not studied it. I mean, I don't know the particulars of the Swedish energy code. What's driven the change in building in Sweden was the 1970s oil crisis.
Right.
At that time, and still today, I mean, Sweden does not have giant oil resources, bought the bulk of their oil energy abroad. And they had a wake-up call at that point, and they made a national effort to improve the energy efficiency of their housing, along with other, you know, energy initiatives in other areas. You know, we went through the same oil crisis, and when it was over, we sort of went back to status quo.
Well, I've discovered that a couple different initiatives in our country, which have been conveniently forgotten, that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, just speaking as a concerned citizen, and also as an architect, after that oil crisis of 1973, our United States government sponsored a lot of research into, if you put it in a macro scale, are called biomass generators. It's wood gasification. And there's all kinds of technology available to make hydrocarbon fuel out of waste materials, wood waste, sewage waste, ordinary compost waste. That has largely been ignored. Now, our Scandinavian cousins have gone to the... this is always a problem when balancing a budget, even in a household budget. Do we conserve, or do we find a better way to carry on the party in a more intelligent way? In the United States, we could have carried on the party in a more intelligent way, and so we've proceeded as if we have created an economy based on biomass conversion, but the dirty truth is that we're still beholden to oil. In Scandinavia, in Sweden, Germany, Germany's not part of Scandinavia. Sorry, Germans. But they're going after the conservation side.
You mentioned the autoclaved concrete, and a lot of European countries have more of a masonry tradition in home building. And
mm-hmm. How does that work into an industrialized production? Does it?
I don't know. You know, I've seen some manufacturers of autoclave concrete that manufacture fairly large planks. Much larger than what we typically think of masonry units.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can assemble a house from that much more rapidly, and again, window openings and significant portions of the house can be, you know, factory fabricated and then, you know, sent out to be assembled. So it definitely can have more of an element of factory fabrication. But to return to why Sweden is informative to us is that they differ in many ways from other European countries because they have a large timber industry, and that has brought on a tradition of building wood houses out of frame.
And right? so do we here in North America.
Right. So now we have taken measures since 1973 to try to increase the efficiency of building a wood house, and they've been very successful to the point where their homes may, on average, use, you know, half of the energy that our houses do here in the United States. And they've done it all by making sensible improvements to the way they build wood frame houses. All of that is very transportable to the way we build wood houses here. And the USA New Wall that you mentioned for my website is...
Which is your invention.
Not my. I almost have to disclaim that and say it's not my invention, but it's my interpretation of a Swedish wall construction done with easy to obtain, you know, American materials.
It's your innovation.
Okay.
And or then suggestion.
The Swedish platform framing is, it's sort of an evolutionary step in the manner of framing a wall. In the United States, their first sort of stud wall construction was balloon framing, and everybody...
Which, for civilians, were very tall studs that went from the bottom of the first floor all the way to the top of the second floor.
Right, because at that time it was easy to get really long trees and really tall lumber. And
yes,
stuff.
And it went up really fast, and then you could just hang the second floor on these really tall, spindly studs that were already up.
And so that was sort of the first stud house framing system in the United States. And that eventually led to what was called the Western platform frame. What the Western platform frame did was it reduced the length of the studs to one story at a time. So that you built the first story, and then you built a platform, which is where that name came from, which was the second floor, and then you built another one-story wall on top of that platform. And so that became the widest application of stud framing in the United States. That's still the way houses are built here.
Absolutely.
Right, Western platform framing. And so Swedish platform framing takes that method and tweaks it in a couple of subtle ways to reduce the number of incidences of thermal bridges between the interior and the exterior. Now, that's significant because, you know, you can make a good wall system that's very energy efficient, it can be very thick and have a lot of insulation in it.
But still you have the studs.
You have the studs, but the wall system can, you know, have ways to thermally break the studs. The Swedish wall systems do. But the thing is that you still have a thermal break where that wall meets the floor, and you still have a lot of thermal breaks where that wall meets the floor above.
Wait. In your new style of construction,
okay,
you got thermal breaks, yes?
There are a few, but a fraction of the number that you have in conventional Western.
Okay, so the difference here is a thermal break means that heat cannot migrate through the construction to the outside that's cold.
Correct.
Or from the outside that's hot into the inside, because we know from the laws of thermodynamics, heat goes from hot to cold.
Correct.
Right.
And that ends up being, you know, even in a well-insulated wall, most of your loss of heat then will be through these places where you have continuous wood from the interior to the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
So the Swedes have had some clever ways that they've reduced that, and it plays into the fact that they're building in the factory, and They are, trying to reduce the amount of work that has to be done in the field. Now, for instance, when we build a wall, there's usually a top plate, and then the second floor is put on top of that top plate, and then a sole plate is put on top of the floor to support the next wall above. So I say plate, that's a horizontal stud in the wall. So each of those plates create thermal breaks that go from the interior to the exterior. So the Swedes have done away with one set of those, and they extended their ground floor wall all the way up to the floor level of the second floor. And then Just like balloon framing, but not all the way up to the roof, but all the way up to the floor above, and that reduces, half of the thermal breaks at a western platform.
I think you mean thermal bridges.
Thermal bridges.
Yes. Okay.
And so, so what that means, though, is when they are building a finished wall in the factory that has drywall on the inside and painted siding on the outside, that means that that will meet the second floor wall panel, and they'll just have a flashing joint, and the total exterior of the wall will be finished. With western platform framing, if you brought in the second floor wall and put it on top of the first floor wall, you'd have a band of unfinished wall
of bridge,
the depth of the flooring.
Yes.
Right. And so they'd have to, in the field, have to introduce siding and flashing, and they'd have to finish that part of the exterior wall. So it not only, works in terms of reducing thermal bridging and increasing the energy performance of the house, but it also makes it faster and easier to assemble on the site after having built it in the factory.
So what I understand is they're putting up very tall, not so wide, slices of the outside wall and then hanging the interior components on that.
Correct.
Yeah. Cool.
And
No. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the hanging of the floor system on the inside of the wall also enables them to establish an airtight barrier layer within the house that the floor joists do not cross, so that becomes part of their system for making the house very airtight.
Right. The whole debate of does moisture come from outside in or inside out probably will have to let go for your return visit, because
that's a very large issue in building science.
It is hugely contentious. We deal with it almost every day. For my dutiful civilian listeners, there's one notion that people and washing machines and cooking are very hot and sweaty, and all that vapor wants to go, of course, out. And if you have ordinary fiberglass insulation in your walls, it will go out through the chipboard, and it will just sit there in the fiberglass, and it will get cold because the outside is cold. We're talking about the wintertime. And then that moisture, because you have a wood stud house, will cause mold, and then your kids will get asthma, and all hell will break loose. Right. Now, people who live in places like Key West, well, if they've got the bucks, they keep the inside cold, and the moisture is outside, and the moisture is coming in.
Right. Now, the wall configurations that I'm showing on the website are intended for heating applications.
Right, where the heating is the major problem with moisture, because the summers are not that moist.
Now, in Sweden, most houses are not air-conditioned, so...
It snows in June in Sweden, so...
I mean, not that, I'm sure there are some houses there that are air-conditioned, but as a overwhelming majority, there's no air-conditioning. So their houses are built, the walls are strictly for that winter condition. They're very open to the outside, so that any moisture that could ever find its way into the wall will always dry to the outside. So
right.
Their walls are very transparent to the outside.
Right.
When you have air conditioning, it changes it, because now the wall that you wanted to perform very well during winter now has a reverse condition during the summer. So there's a couple of ways that you can respond to that.
Let's hold on. What?
Yeah.
Hold that. Wait for that. I know that you're a big fan of mineral wool.
Yes.
Let's have a little happy Danish music and get back to you to talk about that.
Vi to på en barcafé, køber os en kaffe-te. Oh yeah. Min hånd flætter ind i din, jeg siger du min. Oh yeah. Stor by, tæt trafik, sidder fast i dit blik. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Dit smil trænger ind i mig, flammerne bevæger sig.
Hey, we're starting to do. Oh, I'm sorry. I was having a Scandinavian moment. How you doing?
Good.
That was Hey Matematica from Denmark. apparently, they have gotten lots of prizes for that. Where were we, Greg?
Mineral wool insulation.
Yes.
So I'm advocating in these new wall systems to adopt mineral wool insulation.
Me too.
You are? Well, that's great.
Tell us why.
Because it performs much better than fiberglass insulation, which is the overwhelmingly standard insulation that's used in the United States.
Let's go back to where they come from.
Mineral wool is made out of basalt, which is naturally occurring rock.
And you can also make it out of?
Out of slag, which is the sort of the leftover residue from like coal firing or...
Like your local coal burning electric plant.
Right, as well as steel manufacturing also produces it, and concrete manufacturing. So it can also use that slag, which is basically an industrial waste elsewhere.
I like to think of it as a byproduct of our modern life.
So it's heated, it's molten and spun to create, very fine fibers, and it's fashioned into bats, as we call them. Although the consistency of mineral wool is much more firm and much more dense than fiberglass, I try to describe the difference to people. They're both called bats, but anybody that's ever, opened up a wall or seen insulation bats in the Home Depot, it's like a blanket. It has paper or foil on one side, and basically it's like trying to hang a comforter inside your wall. Mineral wool, on the other hand, is more like a cake. It has dimension and shape that is relatively rigid. It's flexible. It's more the consistency of a mattress than a blanket.
And it's like a futon.
It's even firmer than a futon.
I haven't slept on mineral wool, but okay.
Well, if you pick up a 6 foot long piece of mineral wool, it will want to keep its length versus fold and drape. So it can be cut to shape with it's cut with what looks like a very large bread knife, and so it's very friendly to carpenters. I mean, it's the same kind of thing as cutting wood. You measure and you cut, and you end up with something that is a dimension, and so it's very easy to fit it into a stud space and to fill every void in that stud space. Now, there's a lot of prejudice, well-deserved, against bat insulation among our green building professionals because it's so easy to do a bad job with it, to leave lots of gaps, to leave lots of holes, to scrunch it into spaces of trying to make it fit. And it's almost universally panned by anybody that aspires to build energy-efficient housing.
Well, here I have to break in and ask some biographical details.
Okay.
As I understand, you're a friend of Matt Arnold.
Yes, I am.
Did you go to Cooper?
No, I did not.
Ah.
No, I went to Rensselaer in upstate New York.
Oh, well, that's even better.
Why that?
No, really. In terms of engineering foundation. So what I say to people who say that there are gaps and such and so forth, at RPI, were you not taught statistics?
I thought that in comparison to other architects that I've met, without digging myself a hole, I thought that our technical professors were very thorough and smart.
Well, good. So you know that in statistics that 5% of variance is the statistical threshold of variance, right?
Okay.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes. You agree with that, right?
Okay, yes.
Do you?
Sure.
I know it's been a long time. Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. So when I was a student at Cooper, we had this super hot structural engineering professor, Israel Sanik, who was like the godfather of flat plate construction in New York. And he said, in his Cuban inflected way, which I couldn't possibly ever replicate, that if it's less than a 5% variance, it is not statistically important. So, 5% of holes in insulation in a stud wall would be a bunch of big holes.
Yeah, it would.
So I say the naysayers are kind of like statistically unimportant.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think fiberglass insulation has well earned its critics, but I think that both mineral wool and fiberglass are called bats, but they're two very different materials.
Right.
In terms of the way they perform, the way they handle, and the ease, not the ease of installation, because I think installing fiberglass well is a lot of work. I think installing mineral wool well is easier than installing fiberglass well.
Let me ask you a question. Does mineral wool come with a foil, cover?
It does not, and the Roxel is the manufacturer marketing mineral wool to the residential market in North America right now. There are other mineral wool manufacturers, I think Thermofiber, but I don't think that they are taking, they're not approaching it the way Roxel is now marketing mineral wool for residential construction in consumer-friendly packaging, just like you would see fiberglass insulation in the Home Depot. You know,
sure. Well, there's the thing.
Plastic wrap with instructions on it.
Yep. Well, here's the thing. With fiberglass, which is less dense and therefore traps less heat in its interstices, you can get fiberglass insulation with an aluminum wrapper that can be nailed to the studs.
Correct.
And taped, and provides an interior vapor barrier.
Right. Although most residential insulation goes in with a asphalt impregnated craft paper vapor retarder versus a foil vapor barrier.
Right.
And which is fine. I mean, that is great, and it saves a step for installers because the alternative is installing a separate sheet. What it means also is that you have a seam in your so-called vapor retarder or vapor barrier every place.
Which, you know, if the architect's on the ball, requires to be sealed with self-adhesive aluminum tape. But whoever does that, right?
That's never done. Not in the vast majority of housing. I've never seen anybody attempt to tape or seal, the craft paper vapor retarder. So in a sense, what you have is you have a barrier that can stop some moisture laden air from reaching the insulation and potentially condensing. But you have so many holes and so many cuts and opening and electrical boxes that make holes in that barrier that the house will never be airtight, not in any sense that, approaches the kinds of standards for passive house. Perhaps you could achieve Energy Star with that, but you'd never be able to make the very low air change goal that's set in these higher energy performance standards.
Not at that stratum of the composition of the wall.
Right. So,
which is way inside, but we have a rule of thumb. Those of you who are, allow me, Greg. I have a lot of people who are graduated but not architects and also lay people. The rule of thumb is you put the air barrier on the warm side of the insulation. Correct?
Correct.
Right. So, if you have R 19 or let's say 20, let's say you have a whole lot of XPS, extruded polystyrene, on the outside. That would be 4 inches of XPS on the outside of your wall, and then your wall with something or other, you'd put the vapor barrier there. And there's a difference between water and vapor barrier, and that becomes extremely confusing.
Yes. But you said you weren't going to get into that right now.
This is a run-up to our next conversation. I hope that we can have a next conversation.
Absolutely. In the end, the mineral wool that's being offered in the United States right now has a higher R value per thickness. R23 for a 2x6 wall versus R19 for fiberglass. Fiberglass, you can special order in R21. Maybe some places that's carried in stock. I've not seen it. I've always had to press my owners, builders, to order that. So R23 off the shelf, and they also offer bats for 2x8 studs, R28. So,
wow.
Here you can...
Well, that's way beyond the building code because the current commonly held building code, most places in the United States, don't know about Alaska, is R19, which is a 2x6 stud, which is really 5.5 inches thick.
Correct.
Because the lumber people tell us it's a 6, but after they made it all pretty and clean and honed down, it's actually 1/2 inch less. Right?
5.5 inches.
Exactly.
Well, so here, this is what the USA New Wall proposal on my site is all about. It's showing incremental steps that any average house builder will understand and can adopt to slowly improve the performance of their walls until they're getting up to the point where they could easily be building something that could perform at a passive house standard, depending on the climate. And
if they wanted to perform at a passive house standard.
If they wanted to.
Yeah. Well, first, they'd have to know about it.
Right. And that's what the whole assumption is. You know, here is, you know, a pathway where using competencies that the builders already have, that they can begin to experiment in that market with customers perhaps requesting better performance or, you know, just local market pressures starting to demand that house be built better. You know, there's lots of other insulations out there. There's blown-in insulation. Cellulose has become very popular with green-minded builders and, you know, green-minded designers. There's spray foams and all kinds of other high-performance insulations, but they all require a different sequence of construction. They require a different subcontractor, a different set of expertise. That all means that the builder is not going to be familiar with how to price it, how long it's going to take, how it's going to interact with his other construction practices. That's where mineral wool is very familiar. It's a very similar process. And installers that currently work with fiberglass can easily work with mineral wool without revising all their estimating and all of their business relationships and the way that material flows through their operation. So it's an easy substitute to achieve higher performance. And that's what's important about it. I mean, it's not saying that this is the ultimate way to build a wall. This is saying this is a way that you can step up the performance of your wall and still have a handle on what you're doing, still be able to estimate it and price it reliably so that you can remain profitable while you're doing it.
All good. All
yeah.
good. We'll have you back next. This
okay.
has been Burning Down the House. Jack, roll the next one. Thank you. Burning Down the House with Greg, the house expert. I thank you for listening. Keep the faith. Talk to you next time. Jack, just roll this out. Thank you.